This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Cell phone is? Do you check your phone, email, or social media more often than you'd like to? Then like millions of others, you may have a technologically driven impulse control disorder. Tune in this Friday at 11 a.m. for a conversation about technology addiction and how you can break it. Here on KBOO Community Radio 90.7 FM.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, we'll bring you live updates from a foreclosure eviction action in North Portland, as well as the trial of alleged Portland Christmas tree bomb plotter Mohammed Mohammed.
U.S. soldiers Bradley Manning, accused of leaking state secrets to WikiLeaks, is denied the whistleblower defense by the judge overseeing his pretrial. And in Palestine, nonviolent activists are defending a tent city that emerged last week in disputed territory. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, January 17th, 2013. I'm Joey G.
And I'm Jen Chavez. The group We Are Oregon is currently holding an action in Northeast Portland to oppose foreclosure evictions. The action began at 4 p.m. today at the home of Ron and Debbie Austin and their two kids who were forcibly evicted yesterday morning. Here's a clip of Debbie Austin speaking as police removed her from her home at 5 a.m. yesterday morning.
My father fought in the Korean War, in the Second World War. My grandfather fought in the World War, First World War. My great-great-grandfather's fought to free the slaves. My stepson is in the Army right now going to Afghanistan while his father is being evicted out of his home. That's not right. I made those payments. And the judge is wrong.
The Austin family has been actively fighting their foreclosure eviction with the help of activists from We Are Oregon and Occupy Portland. After yesterday's eviction, supporters organized to come together today in the Cully neighborhood, where the Austin family has lived for decades on Northeast 77th Avenue. KBOO's Jamie Partridge is there now and joins us for this live report. Are you on the line, Jamie?
I am. Hello, Jen.
Hi, thank you and welcome. Jamie, can you describe the scene out there at the action?
Yes. We're standing outside in front of the Austin house right now, and if you look up and down the street, there are yard signs in almost every house saying, "We support our neighbors. Don't move out." And right here next to the Austin house is their next door neighbor is a sign that says, "The Austin family has been forcibly evicted from this home by Multnomah County Sheriff Dan Staton and Portland Police. The community stands with Debbie Ron and their children through this difficult time. A bank's profits are not more important than a family's right to their home." There were 25 people that gathered here at 4 o'clock, took clipboards and flyers and information out to the neighborhood to knock on doors to inform the neighbors that the Austin family had been evicted. And many of them knew the Austin family and had actually visited with the Austins in the past year as they've been campaigning to resist foreclosure and eviction. The response has been overwhelming. People have been very supportive and are willing to contact Fannie Mae, who's the mover behind this eviction, and the sheriff's office to express their displeasure.
What are the activists who are behind this action hoping to accomplish after today's action?
Today's action. Well, I'll give you Carrie Coe, who is with We Are Oregon, and she'll tell you what the activists are hoping to accomplish with today's action.
Wonderful.
Hello.
Hi there. So we were just asking Jamie what your organization and other activists are hoping to accomplish with today's action.
So the housing justice community wants to make it extremely extremely clear that the neighbors and the community at large support the Austin family, and that it is obscene to have Fannie Mae, a government-owned institution, put a family out on the street in the dark of night and install a private security force to protect an empty home. We stand with the Austins. We hold the sheriff, Sheriff Staton, personally responsible for this, and we're asking folks in the community to call the sheriff now and let him know that that we support the Austin family, and that, in fact, not only is kicking out the Austins an outrage, but that we want them to end all evictions. No family should have to face being out in the cold and, you know, having their home ripped away from them. So that's what we're out here. We're out here talking to the neighborhood today, canvassing, and asking for people's support in that way.
Wonderful. And what's been the response of the sheriff's office today, if any? Has there been a police presence during your action today?
So there was a police presence during the action, but they were—they seemed to be mainly observing to see what was going on. While we were, while a handful of us were standing in front of the Austin's house, there were, you know, about an equal number of police officers in their cars watching us. So they are, you know, certainly interested in the, you know, what we're doing with the Austin's home, and they seem to have an interest in keeping the Austin's out of their home. But we, you know, we are still doing what we do and are, you know, unintimidated by their presence.
And what are the next steps for the Austin family?
So the Austins are regrouping. They are collecting themselves and, you know, trying to have a moment to breathe and figure out what to do in this difficult time. They are, however, being, you know, supported very much so by their neighbors. So they're staying with families that they know in the community and gathering their belongings and planning their next steps. But those steps are, you know, we're giving them a moment to figure that out.
All right. Well, thank you very much for speaking with us. I've been speaking with Carrie Coe. Is that correct?
Carrie Coe
with We Are Oregon, who have organized the action today. And also our KBOO reporter, Jamie Partridge, is present at the action, joining us live.
I'd love to say, to give folks the sheriff's phone number if they don't have it, if you haven't had a chance to say it yet, so that folks can call in right now to the sheriff and let him know that we support the Austin family.
All right,
that number quickly is 503-988-4300, and that's Sheriff Staton, and you can give him a call directly. If you want more information, you can always look to weareoregon.org, and we'll have everything posted there.
Okay. Thank you very much, Carrie. And Jamie Partridge?
Two lawsuits have been filed against the Canadian tour bus company whose recent crash injured 40 and killed 9. The bus crashed on snowy Interstate 84 near Pendleton, Oregon on December 30th. So far, two separate lawsuits have been filed against tour company Meju Tour and Travel. Prosecutors claim that the tour bus company made decisions based upon cost and profit considerations rather than safety of their passengers. One of the lawsuits was filed in Tacoma, Washington for 5 of the surviving victims, and the other was filed in Canada by a Canadian couple. Factors believed to have caused the crash included driver fatigue and excessive speed for the icy conditions. A U.S. investigation found that the driver had worked 92 hours in the 8 days leading up to the crash and had exceeded the 70-mile-per-hour speed limit. The president of Meju Tour and Travel has been added as a defendant in the case, along with the bus driver.
In a blow to the defense team of U.S. soldier Bradley Manning, accused of releasing documents to WikiLeaks, a judge has denied Manning the chance to use the whistleblower defense in his upcoming military trial. The judge overseeing his court-martial, Colonel Denise Lind, ruled in a pretrial hearing that Manning could not present evidence involving his motives for the leak. The defense had planned to focus on his motives to establish Manning as a whistleblower acting in the public interest, rather than someone who meant to damage U.S. interests or aid the enemy. The defense will also be barred from using evidence they'd gathered to show that WikiLeaks did not threaten national security. Manning is facing the possibility of life in military prison without parole for his role in WikiLeaks' exposure of hundreds of thousands of classified war documents, videos, and diplomatic cables. The prosecution alleges that the 25-year-old leaked the information to WikiLeaks, intending it to be seen by Al-Qaeda. He faces 22 separate charges, including the most serious, aiding the enemy. Earlier, Colonel Lind found that Manning was subjected to harsh military treatment while in detention, often in solitary confinement. But she only reduced his further sentence by about 100 days as a result.
Yesterday marked the 22nd anniversary of the first U.S. invasion of Iraq under George Bush Sr. in 1991. To mark the occasion, Portland Peace and Justice Works held a protest outside FLIR Systems in Wilsonville. FLIR is an acronym for the equipment it produces, forward-looking infrared. The company equipment is heavily used by the military, among other combative groups. KBOO reporter Joe Leno spoke with Dan Handelman with a Peace and Justice Works for more about the protest.
Why did you select FLIR Systems to protest in front of?
Well, FLIR is, we think, one of the most prominent military contractors in Oregon. They've received over $1.3 billion in contracts over the last 5 years with every branch of the military, including the Coast Guard. And they've also contracted with the Customs and Border Patrol for using their infrared equipment on the border with Mexico. And, in fact, they've also contracted with the Colombian government to give them infrared equipment for their so-called war against narcotics and terrorism, which is actually suppressing a leftist uprising in that country. So all told, they do a lot of supplying military equipment that is not for the purposes of human good, but rather, as they say on their website, for targeting individuals, and that means killing them.
And what was the theme of your protest?
The theme was called Good Jobs, Not War Jobs, and we wanted to make it clear that there may be some beneficial uses for infrared equipment. You know, if you have people lost out in the woods and the National Guard or whoever has to go out and look for them, there are probably some useful, beneficial points to having this equipment in our society, but we just don't want it being used for warfare. And people have to really think at the end of the day what they're doing, what they're producing when they go to work. And we also need employers to think about what kind of jobs are going to provide for people, and we want that to be jobs that uplift our society and build a better planet, not ones that are used for death and destruction. So we titled it Good Jobs, Not War Jobs, and we actually got quite a lot of support from people driving up and down Parkway Avenue, Southwest Parkway Avenue in Wilsonville, although we had several employees wander past, give us kind of a nasty little, I pay for you to stand out here. You know, we're with nonprofits, so they think that somehow they support us. And they left before we could say, yeah, but our taxes support your business taking our money and paying for war. So it was sort of a circular argument on their part. One of the points we're trying to make to the employees that, who, as I said, didn't really stop by to talk to us, is that several contractors have now paid the price for being participants in warfare. In just about a week ago, a company in Virginia that helped do translations for the people at Abu Ghraib prison, the notorious Abu Ghraib prison in Iraq, were fined $5 million that they paid to some of the torture victims there because of their participation in the torture. And in November last year, I think everybody knows this, KBR, a national contractor, was fined $85 million for exposing Oregon National Guard soldiers to a dangerous chemical, a cancerous chemical. And so what we're saying is, you know, that FLIR could find itself on the losing end of history by continuing to tie its economic future to America's endless warfare. And we hope that they will do the right thing and choose to stop accepting military contracts.
Yesterday, January 16th,
yes.
Was that date chosen for a reason?
Yeah, well, for two reasons that are connected to each other. It was the 22nd anniversary of when the U.S. started bombing Iraq in 1991, and what's known as the Gulf War, Part One. And that was also the day after Martin Luther King's birthday. And for those of you who weren't around back then, George Bush the First had declared that Saddam Hussein had to remove his troops from Kuwait by January 15th as a deadline, which is actually Martin Luther King's birthday. And it just seemed so horrible to us at the time, everybody in the peace movement at the time, that he would pick Martin Luther King's birthday as a day to say, either you do something or I'm going to start a war. And then he waited, 24 hours until starting the actual bombardment. So we picked it because Martin Luther King called out our nation for being the most violent in the world. And in his speeches toward the end of his life when he was rallying against the Vietnam War, and because it was the anniversary of the Gulf War.
I have been speaking with Dan Handelman of the Peace and Justice Works. This is Joe Leno with KBOO News.
The trial of alleged Christmas tree bomb plotter Mohammed Mohammed began 1 week ago today in a federal courthouse in Portland. Mohammed is charged with trying to set off a bomb during the Christmas tree lighting ceremony in Portland 2 years ago. Undercover FBI agents spent over a year meeting with Mohammed, and defense attorneys say they entrapped the 18-year-old by urging him to engage in violence. KBOO's Joe Meyer is our on-the-site reporter for this trial and joins us now for this live report. Hello, Joe.
Hi, Jen. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Joe, can you give us an update just briefly on what has happened in the trial so far?
Well, yesterday the prosecution called Hussein. He's the second undercover agent that was handling Mohammed. He was posing as an Al-Qaeda bomb expert. And the main arguments the government made yesterday was that the FBI agents were continually giving a way out. They were saying, oh, you can stop now. There's no shame in stopping. They claimed that it was Muhammad's plan. He came up with the location. He came up with Pioneer Square. He came up with the idea of a truck. And also, he took initiative. He did things on his own. So they're obviously anticipating the entrapment defense because the facts here are not really disputed much. The government also portrayed Hussein as sympathetic. And on the stand, the witness even expressed sadness and dismay that the defendant, you know, kept on choosing to go ahead. And today started actually with more wrangling about allowable evidence. We heard in the past that certain FBI files, the planning meetings, the debriefings would not be allowed into evidence. Apparently, Mohammed had contact with an agent named Bill Smith. None of that is allowed prior to the meetings with Youssef and Hussein that basically the court is about now. Today we learned about outtakes. Several times the FBI forgot to turn off their mic after the interviews. So the defendant left and they continued to talk. An example was after the August 9th meeting, which was the first between Hussein, the agents expressed joy. They said that he took the bait, which is kind of the opposite of what they were saying. The government just claimed they were trying to dissuade him, and then they're really partying it up using strong language and celebrating that the kid took the bait. Again, this evidence is not allowed. The defense is somehow allowed to talk about it, but not allowed to present it. And there was a lot of the wrangling before the jury was seated, and they came in around 9:25. Mr. Wax, who's the lead defender, began the day by cross-examining the FBI undercover agent known as Hussein, again, the bomb expert. Now, the government had portrayed him as sympathetic and unsophisticated in social science and psychology. In fact, anytime you mention the word psychology, anyone from the FBI says, oh, I don't know what that is. I don't know what you're talking about. But Mr. Wax challenged this framing, and we learned that Hussein had been on the Joint Terrorism Task Force since 2004. He had extensive training, including FBI classes in interpersonal skills, interrogation, and strategic Islamic source development. Before the FBI, he worked undercover in narcotics and was familiar with the idea of informants working up the drug chain. The defense tried to suggest again that the FBI is using sophisticated social science techniques and religious authority to manipulate the defendant, and the government saying, well, that's just how you talk if you're in Al-Qaeda. I guess the general thread was that the FBI, the defense is claiming the FBI were really amassing a court case. They weren't really assessing Muhammad more than building a case and collecting evidence piece by piece. After reframing the FBI witness, Mr. Wax challenged the government, claiming that the defendant was given a lot of chances, challenging the government's claim that the defendant was giving a lot of chances to get out. The government tapes do indeed show the agents using the words, you can get out. However, the context makes it a false choice. Specifically, the two agents would praise the defendant first, state that he could get out, and then quickly change the subject and ask him a question. The defense called this the 1-2, and from looking at the tapes, that seemed to be largely true. For example, they would say, oh, you know, this isn't for everyone. You can get out. This isn't for everyone. You know, you have to be very tough in order to do this. You can get out. And by the way, did you get those toggle switches? So that's how that went.
I see.
The defense also challenged the idea that Mr. Muhammad took initiative. The tasks were basically spoon-fed to him. You know, they told him to buy a toggle switch. He didn't know how to do it. They said to go to Radio Shack. The idea that the defendant selected Pioneer Square on his own was also in question. The defense pointed out that the FBI had email contact with Muhammad since November 2009, and undercover agent Youssef met with him in person on July 30th, where the tape recorder supposedly didn't work. So to say that Hussein can go to a meeting in August and say, oh yeah, this was his idea, that was called into question. I'm not sure how effective it was. Regarding the August 19th meeting, Hussein asks, so what do you want to do? You know, what do you want to do? What's your target? And Muhammad starts to answer, well, at our last meeting, and Youssef breaks in, just tell them what you told me last time. So I think there's some credence there. We'll see what the jury thinks.
All right. And do you have any expectations as to what will be happening in the trial tomorrow?
Youssef was recalled today for brief questioning by the government, and there'll be more cross-examination of him tomorrow.
All right. Well, thank you very much again, Joe. Again, we've been speaking with KBOO's Joe Meyer, reporting live on the trial of Muhammad Muhammad, accused of the attempted bombing of the Portland Christmas tree lighting 2 years ago. Thank you for joining us, Joe.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6, featuring Alaskan Native American artist and musician Philip Charette, and local organizers with Idle No More. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio News and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be clear, up after some patchy morning fog to be mostly sunny, with a high near 45 degrees. Tomorrow night will be mostly cloudy, with more fog and a low around 31 degrees.
It's 5:23, time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
In the scramble to fix the federal deficit, one of Washington's worst ideas is widely considered by political elites, including some Democrats, to be a good idea, even a painless fix. The idea is to raise the age of eligibility for both Social Security and Medicare, shoving it from 65 to 67 or beyond. After all, goes Washington's conventional wisdom, people live so much longer now, so it won't hurt to postpone eligibility and save a couple of years of taxpayer outlays to people. But, as economist and columnist Paul Krugman has pointed out, this bit of conventional wisdom is merely conventional, in the sense of trite. While life expectancy has gone up on average, it has not increased much for working stiffs, especially tens of millions of lower-wage and poor workers. Unlike being a member of Congress, the work that these people do tends to require heavy lifting, which can make you old fast. Requiring them to do it even deeper into old age and to wait longer for medical assistance is, as Krugman bluntly calls it, cruel. Bear in mind, too, that working-class families are precisely the people who count on Social Security and Medicare. They don't have the socialized medical benefits and golden pensions that those pampered conventional wisdom spouters in Congress get. Oh, one more thing. The purported savings from this fix are so minimal as to be illusory. In fact, shoving ill or crippled elderly workers out of the cost-effective Medicare system will jack up America's health care costs. This is Jim Hightower saying, so raising the retirement age is gratuitous as well as cruel, but mostly it's severely ignorant. What's at work here is a policy-making elite that includes no working-class people, so it can cluelessly believe that making the lives of these Americans worse is painless.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, HightowerLowdown.org.
As the debate on gun control rages throughout the country, a news reporter by Mother Jones Magazine shows that the bureau charged with enforcing gun laws in the U.S. has been completely gutted by legislatures working with the National Rifle Association. This has created the situation we have now, where the gun industry in the U.S. highly unregulated and guns are extremely easy to obtain and difficult to track. The reason, according to the Mother Jones investigation, is a concerted effort by certain legislators who have pushed the agenda of the National Rifle Association to hinder the work of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, or ATF. In President Obama's statement on gun control yesterday, he called on the Bureau to enforce existing gun laws. The problem is the ATF no longer has the power to do so. The 1986 Firearms Owner Protection Act made it all but impossible for the government to prosecute corrupt gun dealers. It prohibited the Bureau from compiling a national database or retail firearm sales and reduced the penalty for dealers who falsified records from a felony to a misdemeanor. In addition, the ATF is explicitly prohibited from conducting more than one inspection of a single dealer in a given year, meaning that once an agent has visited a shop, that dealer was free to break the law. The ATF's budget has been virtually the same for decades, and it currently has fewer investigators than it did in 1973.
New documents exposed by the Associated Press have revealed that the Environmental Protection Agency dropped an investigation on the impact of hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, on drinking water. The investigation was initially launched in 2010 after a Texas resident reported his water bubbling like champagne and the water from his hose igniting. The EPA immediately filed a rare endangerment order for high levels of methane found in the water, but more than a year later withdrew the order with no explanation. Today, reporters with the Associated Press revealed that even though the EPA had scientific evidence against the drilling company Range Resources, the agency set aside this evidence after Range Resources sent a complaint to the EPA in Washington. The company refused to cooperate with the investigation, arguing that the link between fracking and drinking water was not based in science. Instead of presenting its evidence, which was obtained using scientific methods, the EPA dropped the investigation and declared the company not responsible. In response to today's report, Americans Against Fracking voiced outrage that the EPA would fold under pressure by deep-pocketed gas and oil companies and called on the EPA to reopen the investigation.
New research has determined that a toxic BPA replacement, BPS, disrupts hormones and is a cause for concern. Products containing the replacement chemical are just about everywhere, from receipts to polycarbonates and also food and water containers. Environmental Health News states that 93% of Americans have traces of BPS in their urine. After BPA, bisphenol A was found to cause harmful effects, including breast cancer, prostate cancer, reproductive defects, and diabetes, it was taken off the shelves. However, its replacement BPS, bisphenol S, has been exposed by a study at the University of Texas to be dangerous as well. The study found that low concentrations of BPS, the amount likely found in food, are likely to the disruption of estrogen. Biochemistry professor and lead author in the new study, Watson, warns that both natural and unnatural hormones like BPS can have effect on surprisingly low doses. Watson also cautions that the practice of introducing chemicals into the marketplace without properly testing them first needs to be reevaluated.
North Carolina's efforts to move toward renewable energy are under attack by new legislation written by the American Legislative Exchange Council, also known as ALEC. Heading this assault is Republican Representative Mike Hager. Hager is a former employee of Duke Energy, a major coal producer, and a member of the corporate front group ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council. To push back against clean energy laws, Representative Hager plans to use a bill known as the Electricity Freedom Act, a model bill co-written by ALEC and the Heartland Institute, a fossil fuel-funded think tank. This bill reverses the state's renewable energy portfolio standards, also known as REPs, which help promote alternative energy like wind and solar. Representative Hager says that he is confident he has the votes needed to weaken or undo his state's renewable energy requirements. This may not be an empty threat. According to the Center for Media and Democracy's Source Watch, 45 of North Carolina's GOP are said to be ALEC members.
The Federal Aviation Administration has grounded new Boeing Model 787 Dreamliner aircrafts in the U.S. amid safety concerns over a potential flammable battery in the planes. Air carriers in Asia, Europe, and Africa have done the same after two incidents in the past week of lithium-ion batteries used in 787s leaking corrosive battery fluid and starting fires. In Boston last week, a battery fire that started after passengers had deplaned took nearly an hour to put out. And in Japan Wednesday morning, a Dreamliner had to make an emergency landing after they discovered leaked electrolyte fluid and burning around a battery in the front of the aircraft. Initially, the government response was less serious, with officials publicly declaring the plane safe, even after a safety review of the planes was underway at their behest. But now the FAA says that Boeing must prove that batteries are safe before it intends to put 787s back in the air. 787s use the batteries as backup power sources in the most electrically powered airliner currently on the market. By reducing traditional pneumatic and hydraulic systems and powering the plane's functions instead with unprecedented amounts of electricity, 787s became lighter, simpler in design, and more fuel-efficient than other airliners. In spite of problems the batteries have caused for other manufacturers, Boeing chose to stick with lithium-ion batteries even after strict flight tests, certification for the planes, and years of debate on the subject. Now Boeing CEO Jim McInerney has said in a statement that they're confident in the plane's integrity and that they're committed to supporting the FAA investigation, which will try to determine the root of the problems. Boeing declined a request by KBOO for a recorded interview, but a representative contacted by KBOO reported reiterated McInerney's statement. While he was unable to comment on the battery, the content of the investigation or the speculation that a recent push for higher production may have caused manufacturing problems, he did say production of the planes would continue as normal. He confirmed that this includes a plant in Gresham, Oregon, where several parts of the 787 plane